From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. Does golf need another great rivalry to get people back on the course? Ahead on Only a Game, imagining a Tiger-Rory rivalry. Also, why the Chicago Cubs' Theo Epstein is miffed by Major League Baseball's alleged gift to the Cardinals. Wiffle ball luminaries converge for an all-star game of sorts. And Only a Game's Doug Tribou ventures to Scotland to witness the Commonwealth Games. Also ahead, the senior hockey tournament created by cartoonist Charles M. Schulz.
He just wanted people to have a good time and really enjoyed it. And most of them have contributed to hockey in their communities. They've been coaches, they've been referees, they've supported the junior hockey club. You know, this is their reward. This is their summer camp.
Stay tuned. This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. The proposed NFL concussion settlement remains a contentious issue. U.S. District Judge Anita Brody conferred preliminary approval on the settlement earlier this month. She will hold a fairness hearing on November 19th. Sports on Earth writer Patrick Ruby is among those who've said the agreement is flawed. Patrick, seven former players have asked a federal appeals court to intervene on their behalf. What's their main complaint?
So the biggest thing they bring up in their actual appeal and objection is the case of CTE, chronic traumatic encephalopathy. That's the disease, you know, that Mike Webster had. It was found in his brain. It was at the heart of League of Denial. In the terms of the settlement as proposed right now, you know, diseases like Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, ALS, dementia, all pay out with certain levels of cash awards. With CTE, it only pays out if you have, quote unquote, death with CTE. However, there's a cutoff date for that death. You have to have died between January 1st, 2006 and July 7th, 2014, the date of preliminary approval of the settlement. So every single NFL retiree going forward, and there's about 20,000 of these guys, if they're still alive to hear this right now and they die and they have CTE and they suffer and their families suffer, they're going to get nothing for that.
Christopher Seeger, co-lead counsel for the plaintiffs, says the contention by former players that those with CTE will not get paid is something, quote, they just get wrong. He has said, if you get sick, period, you get paid. Should that rebuttal be reassuring?
No. Christopher Seeger is a lawyer. He's not a scientist, and I'm not sure if he's aware of the actual science at play here. They found that in general, this is a recent study from 2013, they looked at 33 players who was diagnosed in their brains after death, and they found that there's basically two groups, two sort of different strains of this, of how the symptoms present themselves. One group, the symptoms come when you're older. They tend to be cognitive, which means you have things like memory loss. Get this in your 50s, your 60s, your 70s. The second group, the symptoms come when you're younger. And they tend to be things like mood disturbances, behavioral problems. This is the group of Junior Seau. This is the group of Dave Duerson, you know, both of whom committed suicide, both of whom were later found to have CTE in their brains, both of whom were fairly young when that happened. They were in their 40s. Those kinds of symptoms, the settlement does not screen for those. The settlement has what's called a baseline assessment program. It's all cognitive tests. So, yes, if some of your CTE symptoms overlap with the symptoms of dementia, it may catch that, and it may pay out, but it's not going to catch out or pay out if you have these other symptoms. And by the way, in that study, the group with the emotional mood problems coming out of CTE, they were the larger group. They were twice as big.
Of course, the argument for getting this settlement approved quickly is that there's a lot of people who need money now because they're in real trouble. Is that a compelling argument?
You know, I think that there is a lot of compellingness to that from the standpoint of, there are players who are in, you know, later stages of dementia, or they have ALS, which is a terrible wasting disease, or they've got Alzheimer's or Parkinson's, and absolutely, they should be helped right now. The NFL makes a lot of money. The NFL, if it wants, can take care of the guys that are in the worst shape right now. For that matter, so could the players' union. So could maybe the top players' attorneys. We should make a note here that Chris Seeger, Saul Weiss, and four other lawyers who did all the negotiating with the NFL and did not do any discovery in this case, by the way, did 12 days of negotiations before coming to a settlement. they stand to make a separate payment of $112.5 million. So they've got some financial incentive to get it pushed through.
Finally, Patrick, do you think Judge Brody is likely to approve the settlement as it stands, despite the objections of some of the former players?
That's a great question. And right now, I'm really not sure. I mean, she seems to be wanting to get this out of her courtroom. The reason I say that is the objection itself that these seven players filed, it was actually filed the week before she gave preliminary approval of the settlement. In her preliminary approval notice, she said there was no objections. That's not good for the objectors. That being said, if there is that groundswell among players, if they look at this deal and say, you know what, this isn't good enough, a bunch of us are going to opt out, or a bunch more of us are going to object, or tons of us are going to show up at that fairness hearing and raise all sorts of problems. And on top of that, if we actually had more concern in the media and it becomes more of a bigger story, that all of that together could put a lot of pressure on Judge Brody to say, you guys need to come up with a better deal.
You can find a link to Sports on Earth writer Patrick Ruby's story titled Under Further Review at onlyagame.org. Patrick, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Bill, thank you so much for having me on. Anytime.
Only three men have won three of golf's major tournaments by the age of 25. Jack Nicklaus, Tiger Woods, and Rory McIlroy. McIlroy's impressive performance at the British Open last weekend landed him in that esteemed group. Tiger Woods' dismal showing at the same tournament reminded ESPN's Pharrell Evans that Tiger is not the golfer he once was. Pharrell, thanks for joining me.
Oh, it's good to be with you.
You point out that McIlroy and Woods used the same red Nike driver last weekend. Nice visual detail. Did their games have anything else in common?
Not much. Rory McIlroy hit his driver for 4 days masterfully. You know, was able to just chew that course up. Meanwhile, Tiger is struggling to find a fairway. And when he did find a fairway, he was hitting 5 and 6 irons. And, you know, oftentimes Rory was hitting 8 and 9 irons. Mm. And that's not a game that you're going to win.
Jack Nicklaus was in his 60s by the time Tiger Woods came to prominence, so their rivalry was pretty much limited to the record books. But Woods and McIlroy could cross paths, and you seem to be hoping that they will, in fact, become rivals. Why is that?
Well, I think that's the hope of the game. I mean, right now, you know, the game of golf is struggling. Rounds of golf are down. Dick's Sporting Goods just laid off PGA professionals because they can't move product in their stores. So Tiger has the ability to galvanize interest in a way that no one does.
It's been more than 6 years since Tiger Woods has won a major, and he is at risk for ending the year without a top 10 finish in a major for the first time in his career. Does it seem likely to you that he will recover his game well enough to challenge McIlroy?
You know, I want to say yes, but Tiger will be 39 in December. With his injuries and his swing seems to be in flux, he cannot hit the driver in the fairway. You know, it's going to be very, very tough. I mean, the game is as deep as it's ever been. So I'm not sure Tiger at his best is going to be able to beat Rory McIlroy or even some of the other players.
The game of golf is suffering a well-publicized decline, as you have mentioned. Would a Woods-McIlroy rivalry, should it actually manifest itself, be something that would bring fans back in large numbers to the game?
I think you will have great buzz around a rivalry with those two guys, but I don't know if that's going to mean that we're going to have more people buying more golf equipment and playing more rounds of golf. So I think in the short term, I think it's great for TV ratings and people talking about the game, but I don't know if that's going to bring more people actually to the game.
Pharrell Evans covers golf for ESPN.com. Thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you.
This month's edition of HBO's Real Sports with Bryant Gumbel looks more closely at the decline in the golf industry to which Pharrell Evans just referred. Over the last 8 years, participation in the sport has declined 20% in the U.S., and on average, 130 courses have closed each year. But the Real Sports investigation did find plenty of golfers at a place called Top Golf, where golf skills are not required, but patience often is. Top Golf has become so popular that visitors will wait hours to tee off. Top Golf CEO Ken May joins me. Ken, welcome to Only a Game.
Hey, Bill, how are you?
Very well, thank you. Tell me first, Ken, what is Topgolf? Where do people play it? And how are you drawing such crowds?
Well, players hit balls with microchips inside them at targets for points. There are targets that are built out into an outfield.
Mm-hmm.
And so once the ball goes into the target, you know, points are accumulated on a screen right behind the golfer. And so it makes golf a lot more approachable than a traditional golf course because you don't have the huge upfront investment of equipment. It's a lot quicker game. It doesn't take 4 to 5 hours to play. And it's not intimidating for somebody who's never played before. So all in all, it's just a great experience.
And no mosquitoes.
No mosquitoes. No, just a lot of golf balls.
Now, are your clients typical golfers just taking a break from the country club scene?
No, not at all. I mean, 50% of our guests will say that they're non-golfers. We're bringing in a younger, more female clientele into the game.
And where are these facilities where people can encounter Topgolf?
Right now, we have 3 facilities in London and 10 facilities in the U.S., in Dallas, there are 3. Houston, Texas has 2. Austin, Texas has 1. 1 in Scottsdale, Arizona. 1 in Alpharetta, Georgia, and right outside of Atlanta.
Mm-hmm.
1 in Chicago and 1 in Washington, D.C. But we're opening up 3 more by the end of the year and 10 next year. So we have a pretty aggressive growth plan.
Do you think that Topgolf is creating more golf fans or just more Topgolf fans?
I think it's both. I mean, it's evident that people that come into our facility that have never played golf before, it happens all the time, and that they'll come, they'll start playing our game, but then they'll want to get better. A lot of times they will buy a package of lessons as a result of just tasting the experience.
One of the things that I've heard from people who want to try and make golf more popular, arrest this decline that we've been talking about, is make it easier by making the hole about 4 times as big as it currently is. How do you feel about that?
As a traditional golfer, I don't like the idea. I think shortening the game would be more important than making the hole bigger. So, you know, requiring people to hit off of tees that are further up, I think would be a better idea than for making the hole bigger.
So this is great. You're a traditionalist, but you've got this game where people hit targets and they're finished very quickly.
Yeah, I love the game of golf, and being able to bring more people to the game, I just think is just magical. I mean, and you can come to one of our facilities and just walk around and look at the people that would never touch a golf club in their life out there. Just you know, they're having the times of their life. So it's amazing to me to see that experience. And you know, I think that we are going to revitalize the game of golf. We are going to help the game of golf thrive.
Ken May is the CEO of Topgolf. Ken, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Bill, thank you. Appreciate your time.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Ahead on Only a Game, you don't have to be Snoopy or Woodstock to skate in the hockey tournament created by Peanuts cartoonist Charles M. Schulz. But first, Major League Baseball's competitive balance draft lottery was held on Wednesday, and it would have passed nearly unnoticed if Chicago Cubs president of baseball operations Theo Epstein hadn't complained about the St. Louis Cardinals receiving a bonus draft pick in 2015. ESPN's Tim Kirchen is here to explain what happened. Tim, begin by telling us what the competitive balance draft lottery is and why it was implemented a couple of years ago.
Because there's no salary cap in baseball, baseball has determined that the only way beyond luxury taxes and taxing these big market teams is to give these small market teams a bit of a break when it comes to draft picks, because baseball understands that the only way some of these small market teams can win is to draft and develop properly. Even though it's expensive, it's not nearly as expensive as the free agent route, and this was a way to get the smaller market teams involved, get them a few extra picks here and there, and might put them on another level with some of the bigger boys, and the Cardinals were part of that this year.
Theo Epstein has pointed out that the Cardinals were doing just fine without what he called a gift in the form of an additional draft pick. They really didn't need it, according to him. Is this just sour grapes because the Cardinals are the Cubs' arch rival?
I think there's certainly something to that, and there's certainly something to the fact that the Cardinals have a great farm system. They just keep churning out young players, especially young pitchers with power arms, and I'm sure Theo didn't really mean anything by it. He was very complimentary of the Cardinal organization. Hey, They don't need any help. They've been a dominant team for the better part of a century, he said, and he's absolutely right. So I don't think he was challenging the system. He was just wondering, hey, we're trying to help the teams that need help, and the Cardinals don't need any help. That's how good they are. So don't give them any more help than they deserve.
Is it too early to say which other teams benefited from this year's lottery?
It's way too early, Bill, because as you know, one of the beauties of baseball is that you never know about young players these days. Only the Cardinals stand out as a team that kind of beat the odds and ended up where they did. The Cardinals lost Albert Pujols to free agency a few years ago, and the pick they got as a compensatory pick turned out to be Michael Wacha, who's one of the great pitchers in the game today. And believe me, there were people all over baseball saying, look at this, classic Cardinals. They lose their best player and they fill in without him, and then they use this draft pick to select the absolute right guy. Again, this is a case where the Cardinals are really good, not necessarily really lucky.
Do you know if anybody connected with the Cardinals said to Theo Epstein, hey, why don't you shut up and fix the Cubs?
I don't think anyone had to say that. I think it's pretty obvious. The Cardinals have been really good for a long time here. The Cubs haven't won the World Series since 1908. And Theo, for all the really good work he has done behind the scenes, and he has done some really good work, anyone who would even look at the Cubs and say, oh, Cardinals, Cubs, it's not even worth it. That's the point. So I think the Cardinals are a little bit above saying, hey, we didn't do anything wrong. You guys are 15 under 500 again. I don't think anyone needs to tell the Cubs to keep their mouths shut.
Tim Kirkjian is a senior writer for ESPN, and, of course, he's our baseball guy here at Only a Game as well. Thank you, Tim.
Thank you, Bill.
At about 8:30 last Sunday morning, a half dozen wiffle ball enthusiasts began assembling the field that would host a best 2 out of 3 series of All-Star games between the most accomplished wifflers in Massachusetts and New Hampshire and their counterparts from New York and Philadelphia, dubbed vaingloriously the World All-Stars. The field, which took up most of the gently sloping front yard of a large home in Danvers, Massachusetts, featured black cylindrical outfield walls, which had to be inflated with a leaf blower. There were yellow canvas lines tacked to the grass to distinguish singles from doubles, and a backstop featuring a metal target and a couple of corporate logos. According to Jason Doucette, a player who'd driven down from Laconia, New Hampshire, the logos were a little misleading.
Not a lot of people sponsor wiffle ball, money-wise. Like, we stick together, we try to help each other out, our team, and we do what we can to help each other out, you know.
You've got a Golden Stick Wiffle Ball League cap on and a New York Yankees sweatshirt. You're not sponsored by the Yankees, are you?
No. I'm just a little cold.
Wiffle ball began with the marketing of the white plastic ball and yellow plastic bat in 1952. 60 years later, a league called Golden Stick was born in this very yard in Danvers. So much for the past. According to Pat Vitale, a 62-year-old pitcher, the future of the game is exceedingly bright.
Next year, there will be a true professional draft, and we will draft pro teams for the first time.
That sounded impressive, and I asked Pat Vitale if that meant the game's best players would actually be able to identify themselves as pro athletes, meaning they'd receive actual paychecks.
At least on a part-time basis, they'll be able to do that. The picture for it is a tour that's similar to pro beach volleyball. We'll take a traveling road show, we'll go to major cities, we'll do these mini tournaments and crown a winner at the end.
Betting on that golden vision might be a risky proposition. Certainly some of the players who would benefit from its realization weren't letting dreams of wealth and fame distract them from the business at hand on Sunday, the All-Star Game. Perhaps in part because of a recent cancer diagnosis, Pat Vitale was only scheduled to pitch one inning for the Massachusetts-New Hampshire side. But after Vitale had retired New York-Philadelphia, a.k.a. the world, in order, I asked team manager Lou Levesque, who is also the president of Golden Stick Wiffleball, whether he'd follow that plan.
No, by no means. We're leaving him in there. He'll go right up to the full three if he keeps playing like that. Yeah, awesome.
But you're going to yank him if he doesn't pitch that?
Yeah, absolutely. Cutthroat. Yeah, this is the All-Star game.
Vitaly was similarly impressive in the second inning, baffling hitters with curves and sinkers that pinged the metal target on the backstop for strikes. So when he took the mound for the third, I wandered over to the opposition side of the field and asked a player named Eric, who'd come up to Danvers from Brooklyn, if he was concerned.
He's really good. A lot of good players out here, and I think we'll get to him when we see him a couple times, but yeah, he's doing good. There you go. That's gone. That's gone. That's gone. That's it. I knew we'd get to him eventually, and the food man did it. So it's love of the game. It's just everybody loves it. It's a passion and a competition. So that's what it's all about.
That and tying the score, which is what Eric's teammate had done with one swing of his wiffle bat.
You the guy who hit the home run?
I am the guy who hit the home run.
All right, what's your name?
My name is Anthony Foodman Dioria.
And how'd you get the nickname Foodman?
Well, I'm pretty well fed, so that's why I call him the Foodman.
The food man's home run provided him with the opportunity to run the bases. Guys hitting singles, doubles, and triples didn't do that. As Lou Levesque explained, that's one of the many distinctions between various other manifestations of baseball and wiffle ball, or at least the golden stick version of the game.
He actually has to run the bases when he hits a home run?
When you hit a home run, you try. Yep.
Okay.
Yep. All right, we used to have a rule that if you were ahead by five, you couldn't because it was showboating, and then we agreed that we like showboating. So now it's limitless running, yep.
The Massachusetts team was out-homered, hence out-trotted, in Game 1 of the best 2-of-3 series. They lost to New York-Philadelphia 12-6. But the New Englanders bounced back to win the next two games. The final was a pitcher's duel that ended 3-2. Observers of that all-star series, and they were pretty much limited to close friends and family members in lawn chairs and a couple of dogs, can debate whether Sunday's games moved the sport toward the establishment of a professional league. At least for Pat Vitale, the food man, Lou Levesque, and the rest of Sunday's All-Stars, the dream lives. To experience a condensed version of the wiffle ball game I witnessed last weekend, check out the video link at onlyagame.org. Charles M. Schulz will be forever known as the cartoonist who for five decades brought the Peanuts to life in newspapers around the world. But he also loved to play hockey. Schulz's love for the sport was occasionally expressed in scenes depicting Snoopy and Woodstock playing hockey in a frozen birdbath. But 40 years ago, he took that love even further by establishing a hockey tournament played each year at an ice rink just north of San Francisco. From Santa Rosa, California, KQED's Dan Brecky reports.
Put it over. Got one. Behind you.
Meet Gary Powdrill, 69 years old, from Greenfield, Indiana.
Carry it!
Less than a year ago, he was having a quintuple bypass, open heart surgery. Right now, Powdrill is focused on a tight game between his Central Massachusetts Rusty Blades squad and the hometown Woodstock Flyers. And things aren't going so well.
Why get rid of it when there's nobody there? Oh, no.
The Rusty Blades are one of 68 teams playing in Snoopy's Senior World Hockey Tournament. It's an event created by Peanuts cartoonist Charles Schulz, Sparky Schulz, to his family and hockey buddies at the beautifully eccentric arena he and his first wife built. The tournament is for players from age 40 up, with divisions set aside for 50, 60, and 70-year-olds. Steve Lang is one of the 1,000 or so players who has suited up this year. He's skating for the Woodstock Flyers. The name refers to Charles Schulz's little yellow bird character.
Unfortunately, we don't fly like the bird.
The Flyers and Rusty Blades are fighting for third place in a division for players 60 and older.
We're playing in 60, but we got ages from 76 down to about 62, so I'm 75. You know, we think like rabbits, but skate like turtles.
This isn't the NHL. The rules don't allow checking or slap shots, and penalty minutes count against you in the standings. But this is hockey, and the play, focused on position and passing, is still demanding.
How's it going?
Huh?
How's it going?
You can tell. I'm starting to sound like a steam engine now. Puff, 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 and it isn't from steam. It's from lack of steam.
When's your last goal?
Oh, God. I don't know. No, I haven't scored in the tournament yet.
New Yorker Bob Santini is 82 and playing on an age 60 and up squad for the New York Apple Corps team. He's played in the Snoopy's tournament since Sparky Schulz first brought it to Santa Rosa in 1975.
Well, I try to do the best I can, but the most important thing about a tournament like this is the camaraderie. I've been coming here for almost 40 years and seeing the same people that come here and meet old friends that I see like once a year. And the camaraderie is probably the most important thing.
Jean Schultz, Sparky's widow, says that's just the way her husband wanted it.
He just wanted people to have a good time and really enjoyed it.
She says everything about the tournament is set up to encourage that. A leisurely game schedule, leaving lots of time to socialize or visit the nearby wine country. Jean Schultz says her husband wanted to give something to his fellow hockey fanatics.
He said all these people who came, most of them have contributed to hockey in their communities. They've been coaches, they've been referees, they've supported the junior hockey club. You know, this is their reward. This is their summer camp for old hockey players.
She says the arena was also her husband's gift to anyone who loves skating. At the insistence of his first wife, Joyce, the facility was designed with a Swiss village motif with meticulously executed murals of alpine countryside.
Sparky was always proud that this was not just a sheet of ice in a warehouse, but a beautiful setting to skate also.
Local hockey players still remember Schultz as a competitor and friend. Phil LeBrun is one of those who still comes to Snoopy's home ice each year to mark the cartoonist's passing.
We get out in the center of the ice and do a quick memorial service for him and thank him for all the things that he's done.
LeBrun is captain of a Schultz-sponsored team called the Great Pumpkins, and what he remembers is someone who enjoyed giving.
I didn't have a team to play on, so he said, put one together. So that's pretty generous. You know, he built this ice rink for people to have fun. He did the tournament for everybody. There's not a tournament like this in the world. There's a lot of hockey tournaments, but there's not a hockey tournament like this where the goal is to have fun. It's about making friends and seeing those same friends year after year.
LeBrun says that's what will keep him coming back to Snoopy's senior tournament. And Rich Haskell, from near Austin, Texas, hopes to return too. He started playing hockey at age 12, 65 years ago, and had a couple goals this year for the Rusty Blades age 70 team.
I don't know. I just love the sport. It's just as long as I can, I'm going to. You know, one day they'll carry me off the ice, and that'll be fine.
For Only a Game, I'm Dan Brecky in Santa Rosa, California.
Chuck Knobloch, who retired from Major League Baseball in 2002, was supposed to have been inducted into the Minnesota Twins Hall of Fame on August 23rd. After Knobloch was arrested on Wednesday and charged with assaulting his former wife, the Twins canceled the ceremony. Knobloch is due in court on July 30th. Ray Rice, who was employed as a running back by the Baltimore Ravens, would like to have been available for his team's opening game against the Cincinnati Bengals on September 7th, but on the basis of his arrest on domestic violence charges in February, this week Rice was suspended for two games. He was fined $529,411.24. All other things being equal, he will be paid the remainder of his $40 million contract. There has been speculation that NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell did not come down harder on Ray Rice because Rice's wife, the victim of the domestic violence, asked the commissioner to consider the potential damage to her husband's reputation, something Rice himself had neglected to consider. There's been speculation that the Twins acted as quickly and decisively as they did because Chuck Knobloch had been convicted of assaulting a previous wife 4 years ago, for which he was sentenced to a year's probation. Skeptics might note that Knobloch hasn't helped anybody win a baseball game for 12 years, whereas many fans may tune in to see Ray Rice try to help the Ravens beat the Browns on September 21st. It's worth repeating that when Chuck Knobloch was convicted of hitting his wife in 2010, he was sentenced to probation. It's also worth noting that elsewhere in the NFL this week, Josh Gordon of the Cleveland Browns is appealing the one-year suspension Commissioner Goodell handed him for failing a drug test. Granted, Gordon has a short, undistinguished history of intoxication-related crimes and misdemeanors. Still, if you are employed in the NFL and you're inclined toward criminal behavior, you're likely to be treated more harshly for smoking marijuana or taking Adderall without a prescription than you are if you hit your girlfriend or your wife. The determination that probation was the appropriate punishment for that assault in 2010 probably came with explanations. Commissioner Goodell's letter addressing Ray Rice's domestic abuse includes the requisite language about the importance of the integrity of the players and the game. women who've been assaulted by men aren't the only ones likely to regard that as more of the shameless, dangerous, hypocritical nonsense still common within and beyond the world of games. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, 5.5 hours behind the leader, the last place rider in the Tour de France makes history. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for our look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
NFL training camps are back in session. America's long wait is finally over.
I thought I recognized confetti on your shoulders.
Yeah. What do you think of the way Indianapolis Colts wide receiver Reggie Wayne showed up for his first day back on the job?
Reggie Wayne is very cool. He showed up one year in a helicopter. This year he showed up in an Indy car, although it was a two-seater, so I think that sort of makes it an inauthentic Indy car.
On Thursday, Charlie, the NFL suspended Baltimore Ravens running back Ray Rice for 2 games. In February, Rice was caught on video allegedly assaulting the woman who would shortly thereafter become his wife. Were you among those disappointed by the penalty?
No, I was among those disgusted by the penalty. This is an embarrassment. This is an indication of what a tin pot dictator Roger Goodell really is. All I can say is it's a good thing Ray Rice wasn't smoking dope when he knocked his wife out on video camera in the elevator, because then Roger Goodell would have been serious.
Yeah, and if he'd called her an ugly name, he'd be suspended
for
years and years. Yeah. Michael Sam, drafted by the St. Louis Rams, said of football analyst Tony Dungy this week, "Thank God he isn't a St. Louis Rams coach." Wait a minute, I thought Tony Dungy was a pretty good coach.
Yeah, he's a pretty good coach and a pretty nutty Christian, actually. He's, you know, taken awards from the American Family Association. He's a rather public homophobe. And when somebody like Tony Dungy talks about quote-unquote distractions, what he's really saying is, ooh, ick. So, yes, I think Michael Sam was remarkably generous in his response.
In basketball news, the Cleveland Cavaliers have signed number one draft pick Andrew Wiggins. That move shelves at least for the next 30 days the trade of Wiggins for Minnesota Timberwolves star Kevin Love, but that doesn't mean that that deal won't eventually happen, right?
No, absolutely not. I still wouldn't make the trade. I would keep Wiggins. I would give Kevin Love almost anybody else on the roster except for LeBron James and Andrew Wiggins, but I suspect the Cavaliers are going to make the deal.
All right, here's some news from the Department of Redundancy Department, Charlie. Donald Sterling is suing his wife, the NBA, and Commissioner Adam Silver. Hadn't he already done that?
We are now in Bleak House. I mean, they aren't going to untangle this lawsuit until Donald Sterling's great-grandchildren are filing lawsuits.
Clippers point guard Chris Paul says he's considering sitting out if Donald Sterling is still the owner of that team once the season begins. And coach Doc Rivers is reportedly considering leaving the team altogether if that's the case. Is this sort of talk unprecedented?
It is to an extent. This kind of talk on the record based on something your owner did is sort of unprecedented. I'm just waiting for Donald Sterling to file the inevitable lawsuits against Chris Paul and Doc Rivers.
For saying nasty things about him. Former manager Tony La Russa is celebrating his induction into baseball's Hall of Fame this weekend, Charlie, and he's gone on record as saying there should be a few more players standing next to him. Who does he think they should be?
He wants Roger Clemens, Barry Bonds, and Mark McGwire in there. I still wouldn't put Mark McGwire in the Hall of Fame, even on the merits, because he's a one-tool player. But he wants to rig up some sort of asterisk or modifier on the plaque, I guess, saying that, hey, this was a very weird time in baseball and some people did some stuff. Look, I mean, I'm going to say it again. The Hall of Fame is a museum. It's for old things and dead people. The idea that you have some sort of morality clause to keep people out of a museum is just silly. So I agree with Tony La Russa on this one.
The Yankees won a game on Wednesday night, and my understanding is that the game ball should go to the grounds crew. You want to help me out with this one?
Yeah, the grounds crew couldn't get the tarp out there, and because they couldn't get the tarp out there, the field was uncovered, it got soaked, and the Yankees won because they were ahead 2-1 with one out in the bottom of the fifth inning.
I love it. I love it. Just, you know, somebody in the dugout saying to the head of the grounds crew,
Ixnay on the arpte.
Don't hurry with
Ixnay that Ixnay on the arpte. I like Ron Washington, the Texas manager's explanation. He said, "We were told we can't protest it, but we complained." I'll bet you did.
We have spoken many times about calls to change the venue of the 2022 World Cup, currently slated for Qatar, but now there are calls to move the 2018 World Cup. Have you a position on Russia hosting a major sporting event shortly?
I think that Russia will maintain the World Cup because I don't think anybody at FIFA wants to be the guy who goes to the Kremlin and explains to Vladimir Putin that his actions have cost his country the World Cup, because I think he would be saying hello to his little friends.
When Evander Holyfield is inducted into the Nevada Boxing Hall of Fame next month, Mike Tyson will present him for induction. Need I say what could possibly go wrong?
Nothing could possibly go wrong. I think this is a very nice thing, and I would pay cash money to go see it if Mike Tyson gave Evander Holyfield back the piece of ear he took from it.
I don't think he has it.
I think it's on his trophy case.
Finally, Charlie, we have another world record to celebrate.
Sports!
This may qualify. I don't know. Man. I'm going to invite you to tell everybody about this new world record, but let me first say, kids, do not try this one at home.
Yes. Gagan Satish from Bangalore in India, he may only be 6 years old, but kids, he's a trained professional. Don't try this on your own. It took him 29 seconds to roller skate under, mind you, 39 cars, which means that he went nearly 70 meters with his face 5 inches from the ground.
Limbo.
Again, one of those things I think about and I say, how do you practice that without losing your face? Because you can't do it the first time. I don't know.
I don't even want to speculate on that. I'm going to just, you know, congratulate this kid from afar. And
warn our younger listeners not to do it. No.
You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce at Grantland, among other places. Charlie, thanks very much.
Thanks, Bill.
Heading into the last weekend of the Tour de France, Italy's Vincenzo Nibali is all but assured of a victory. The battle for last place seems pretty well wrapped up as well. That honor goes to Ji Cheng, who at last check trailed Nibali by 5.5 hours. But just by competing, Ji has made history as the first ever Chinese rider at the Tour de France. Ian Austin profiled Ji for the New York Times, and he joins me now from France. Ian, welcome to Only a Game.
Hi, Bill.
Is it fair to say that Ji Cheng has gotten more attention than the Tour's typical last place rider, known also, as I understand it, as the Lanterne Rouge?
Yeah, after the little red light that used to be on the back of a train. Well, I guess he's received more because of his unique status as a Chinese rider. He only moved into the bottom position, though, in the big mountains. So there were other riders who were getting that unwanted attention earlier.
Mm-hmm. Ji Cheng races for Giant Shimano, a team that is headlined by sprinter Marcel Kittel. What is Ji's role on that team?
Well, obviously, Ji's role is not being in first place overall in the Tour de France. He's one of the vast bulk of the peloton. They're guys who are known as domestiques, so, you know, literally servants. And he has a very, very specific job. When you've got a good sprinter, as they do in Kittel, most days on the stage of sprinters are going to win. A break gets away, and it's allowed to go away, sometimes for several hours. At the point where Kittel decides that it's time to shut down the break, G goes up to the front of the riders, and he rides at 55, 60 kilometers an hour until the break's caught, and then he goes out the back.
When you spoke with him, G didn't sound very concerned about his position at the back of the pack. Why was that?
Well, because G takes doing his job seriously. So that means, you know, he works very hard on the flat stages, but when it comes to the big mountains, he showed me some of his power numbers, and they're actually lower when he goes over a huge climb than they are when he's on the flat and cranking it up to chase the breakaway. He just takes it easy.
As you explain in your piece, bicycles continue to be very popular in China. Racing bicycles, not so popular. How did G end up in his line of work?
He was a runner in his youth and quite a high-level one. And he's from Harbin, which is quite a snowy, cold place in China. So in the winter, running wasn't feasible. What most of the runners there did was cross-country ski, but he doesn't actually like the cold, so that was a problem. What the city does have, though, is a velodrome, an indoor bicycle track. So he started going there in the winter instead of out on cross-country skis. He didn't actually, there was another problem with that, he doesn't actually like the track. You know, you go round and round and round. What he did find that he liked was going out on a road bike, which was very unusual for China because basically, until quite recently, Chinese racing has almost entirely been on the track.
At the Tour de France, the crowds are, of course, a factor. Both packs of riders on the course and the spectators alongside it. How has G adjusted to those variables?
A lot of the roads in the Tour de France, Giro d'Italia, which he's also ridden, they're the width of a very small driveway. Mm-hmm. So he had to, first of all, learn how to fight. Well, his first race, it was just he said he couldn't figure out what everybody was fighting over. So they sent him. He came over here. Shimano had a program to bring Chinese riders over to Europe. So they gave him an incredible baptism by fire. After a lot of falling off, G figured it out. The crowd, well, it gives him a headache.
You mentioned in your article that G has ridden in several of the other big races in Europe. Is this something he's going to continue to do?
He seems really determined, although you have to feel a bit sorry for the poor guy. He does a very long and arduous season here, but when he gets back to China, instead of resting up like the guys who are based in Europe do, he has to ride races with the national team. So he went, I think, 4 years without seeing his father. Last November, he got married, had, oh, I don't know, less than 24 days with his wife, and he hasn't seen her since.
Ian Austin is covering the Tour de France for the New York Times. You can link to his article, Last Overall in the Tour but Blazing a Trail, at our website, onlyagame.org. Ian, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you, Bill.
The Summer Olympics in Rio de Janeiro are 2 years away. The next World Cup is in 2018, but another of the world's largest sporting events is happening now, and if you're from the United States, there's a good chance you've never heard of it. From Canada to Cameroon, from Pakistan to Papua New Guinea, more than 4,500 athletes have traveled to Scotland for the 20th edition of the Commonwealth Games. From Glasgow, Only a Game's Doug Tribou reports.
In 1930, 400 athletes gathered in the Canadian city of Hamilton, Ontario, for the first British Empire Games. Except for cancellations during World War II, the Games have been held every 4 years since. As the British Empire changed, so did the name, and Commonwealth Games eventually stuck. Today, the Commonwealth is a voluntary union of former pieces of the empire, 53 countries comprised of 71 nations and territories, and all of them are participating in the Games in Scotland. The first event of the Commonwealth Games is long and slow, but it draws big crowds. The Olympics have a torch, the Commonwealth Games have the Queen's Baton, or baton, as they say here in Scotland.
It's fantastic. This is probably the biggest event that Glasgow will ever have the opportunity of hosting, because we're not a big enough city to host something like the Olympics or the World Cup.
Jim Boyd teaches phys ed at an elementary school in Glasgow. He was chosen to run a short leg of this 118,000-mile relay through all the member nations. It began in October at Buckingham Palace when Queen Elizabeth placed a message for the Commonwealth in the wood and titanium baton. Linda Brown and her husband Adrian turned out to see it pass by. She's been impressed by Glasgow's preparations.
I think it makes you feel proud to be a Glaswegian.
In a city with unemployment rates of over 25%, residents are happy for any economic boost the Games might provide, and many believe local officials planned prudently in order to leave Glasgow better off after the closing ceremony in early August. The 2014 Games feature 17 sports and many of the traditional big draw Olympic events, swimming and diving, track and field, known as athletics here, boxing and gymnastics. Ahead of its 2016 Olympic debut in Rio, rugby sevens is also on the schedule, plus badminton, table tennis, lawn bowling, and netball, a variation of basketball that features hoops without backboards and no dribbling. And there are five sports and a record 22 medal events for para-athletes.
Anybody collecting tickets?
On Wednesday evening, thousands of fans are making their way to Celtic Park, Scotland's largest soccer stadium. The weather is decidedly un-Scottish. Crystal clear skies with temperatures near 80, perfect for the opening ceremony. Fans from Nigeria, South Africa, and Australia stop to chat with me. And if there's one fan that embodies the Commonwealth, it's Long Ismail. He is Malaysian, his wife is Indian, and they live in central London. He says after the 2012 Olympics, these games seem much more intimate.
When I was working as a volunteer for the 2012, you don't see a lot of the athlete walking on the road, whereas over here, I met a lot of the top competitors on the road walking by themselves, you know, with no entourage or someone looking after, and they're really friendly. And I missed that when I was in London.
At the ceremony, the crowd of 40,000 saw Scottish culture celebrated in a lively song and dance routine that included a 30-foot-tall green kilt, golfers, and the Loch Ness Monster. Singers Susan Boyle and Rod Stewart performed, but Queen Elizabeth got a greeting worthy of a rock star before she officially opened the games with the message of camaraderie that she placed in the baton months ago. and you can... Meanwhile, Scotland is preparing for another major event just after the Games. On September 18th, Scots will vote on whether to separate from England and the United Kingdom. As Hugh O'Donnell explained his support for the no vote to me outside the stadium, Dorothy Grace Elder, a former member of the Scottish Parliament, walked by and stopped to give voice to the yes side.
If we vote yes, we will be going to be in big, big trouble. Vote no, vote no.
Absolute rubbish. If people vote no, Scotland will be written off as a nation of cowards, will never be considered again by any British government.
In the Olympics, at least for now, Scotland and England are united as part of Team Great Britain. However, in the Commonwealth Games, each individual country gets its own squad. That's a big part of the appeal for Glaswegian and Team Scotland para bowler Robert Conway.
To represent your own country and in your own city with the name Scotland on your back instead of GB is everything.
Ross Murdoch is going to take the goal for Scotland. Gold to Scotland, silver to Scotland, it is Michael Jameson, and the bronze goes to England and Andrew Willis. An utterly brilliant swim.
And on Thursday, the games began. That's the BBC's call of the men's 200-metre breaststroke. On the first day, the host nation collected 4 golds and 10 medals overall. The field is dotted with former Olympic medalists, including Jamaican sprinter Usain Bolt. There may be athletes from every continent except Antarctica, but Australian field hockey player Andrew Philpott says it's been easy to find a common bond, with a little help from a soccer ball.
Countries are obviously so different, and the way we dress, I mean, the way we sort of behave and stuff. But one of the things that's really been obvious within the village is the shared values. I mean, we'll kick the footy, and if it'll fall over to one of the guys in the African team, they'll pick it up and have a laugh and kick it back. And you realise you've got more in similar with these countries than you might have expected to begin with.
And that's why the Commonwealth Games are also known as the Friendly Games. For Only a Game, I'm Doug Trabue in Glasgow.
Doug Trabue has been keeping a reporter's journal while he's in Scotland. See all his posts and photos at onlyagame.org. Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabue. Our technical director is James Trout. Our assistant producer is Martin Kessler. Our intern is Mark Finn. And our senior producer is Gary Wallen. Our final word this week is from Mary, Queen of Scots.
Yikes!
I'm Bill Littlefield. Thank you for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support comes from the Lemelson Foundation, supporting inventors and invention to improve lives in the U.S. and developing countries, on the web at lemelson.org. The Pew Charitable Trusts, driven by the power of knowledge to solve today's most challenging problems, at pewtrusts.org. And the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting solutions to prevent and end homelessness, on the web at melvilletrust.org. This is NPR.